Just after midnight, in the early hours of March the 1st, 2001, a man dialed 999 from his home in Balbriggan, North County Dublin. His voice was frantic. "My wife has fallen down the stairs. She's not moving. I don't think she's breathing." Paramedics rushed to the terraced house on Clonard Street, and upon entering, lying at the bottom of the stairs, they found 27-year-old Mary Goff. She was pale, cold to the touch, and unresponsive. Her husband, Colin, stood by, distressed. He told them Mary had tripped and fallen down the stairs. But later, under the bright lights of an examination room in Beaumont Hospital, doctors noticed something unusual. Not just about the deceased, but also about her grief-stricken husband. In the resuscitation bay, doctors work on Mary in sequence. Airway, breathing, circulation. A nurse notices faint linear marks high on the neck. A doctor pauses, looks closer. Something is off. The injuries don't appear to be consistent with a supposed fatal fall down a staircase. While the team continues efforts to save her life, a quiet word is passed amongst the staff. Alert, Gardaí. When someone is murdered in Ireland, the Gardaí call in a team of forensic scenes of crime examiners from the Technical Bureau. And for 25 years, I was part of that team. My name is John Sweetman. I was there to read the silent and often hidden clues at a crime scene. I saw what killers tried to hide. Fingerprints unknowingly left behind. Murder weapons hidden in plain sight. Handwriting that betrayed a lie. Every detail told the real story. And now, I'll tell you those stories. In this new podcast from Go Loud, I take you inside some of Ireland's most haunting crimes. This is Lines of Inquiry, a Go Loud original podcast that looks beyond the headlines, following the evidence step by step, and uncovering the stories behind the investigations. In this episode, the shocking death of Mary Goff, a story of love, deception and lies, and a fugitive's desperate attempt to escape justice, leading Gardaí and a heartbroken family to search for years for answers and closure. Mary Goff grew up in the village of Stamullen, County Meath. During Mary's childhood, it was a small rural town with just a few hundred residents. She was the only daughter in a family of six children. Her father died suddenly when she was just 15, and with five brothers, Mary learned from a young age how to stand up for herself. Those who knew her remembered a lively personality. Friends described her as funny and outgoing, and while she was shy, she was someone who could bring a bit of crack to any room she walked into. She was dependable and generous with her time, qualities that made her popular with friends and neighbours alike. In 1993, while working in the Huntsman's Inn, a local pub near her home, Mary met Colin Whelan, a young man from the nearby town of Balbriggan in North County Dublin, which is close to Mary's hometown of Stamullen. Colin was a few years older than Mary. He worked in IT at Irish Permanent in Dublin city centre. Mary and Colin's relationship began casually. There were periods of uncertainty, like all love in your 20s. At one stage in 1995, they separated for several months, but the break was temporary. Each time they drifted apart, they soon reconciled. Mary thought Colin was the one. Mary worked in a few different jobs and industries during her 20s, including film and also in a solicitor's office. By the late 1990s, the relationship had grown more stable. In 1997, Colin bought a terraced house on Clonard Street in Balbriggan. The home was modest, with narrow rooms typical of the houses in the area. A steep staircase rose directly from the hallway. Though small, it was theirs, and it provided the foundation for plans they were beginning to make together. Mary's family treated Colin like one of their own, like a brother, like a son. In 1997, on a Friday night, Colin crashed his car while driving home. He hit another car carrying a local couple, and the passenger in that car, the 61-year-old Elizabeth Murphy, was killed. Colin was charged originally with drink driving, but that charge was dropped and he was found guilty of careless driving. In 1999, Colin proposed. Mary was elated and plans were made for the wedding. The ceremony took place on September 9, 2000, in front of their families and close friends. It was described as a happy and love-filled day, though relatively small and understated. Mary was 27 years old, and one of her brothers walked her down the aisle. Years later, some of Mary's family would look back on this day and say they sensed some nerves in Mary, and maybe that she wasn't quite as happy as they had expected her to be. Maybe just normal wedding day jitters. Or maybe those small moments that look different when you look back years later through a new lens, with a new understanding. The couple went on a honeymoon in Asia, and when they returned, Mary's family felt they noticed a change in her. She seemed a little more distant now. In the months that followed, the couple spoke about renovations to the Clonard Street house and of starting a family in the near future. Alongside the personal milestones came the practicalities of adult life. As part of their preparations for marriage, the couple arranged finances, household responsibilities, and insurances. With the wedding behind them, Mary and Colin settled into married life. Mary remained closely tied to her family in Stamullen, visiting regularly and staying connected with friends she had known since childhood. Colin's IT work involved sometimes working from home. In late 2000 and into early 2001, that routine continued. Mary helped care for her mother, who had some health issues. She remained an important figure in the Goff family circle. Colin spent his time maintaining the house and keeping up his IT contracts. To neighbours, nothing about the couple's life appeared unusual. On the 28th of February 2001, the pair travelled together to Drogheda. They were attending a detox programme run by a homeopath. They made the journey to collect the results of a blood test. Mary had been trying to get healthier. The visit was unremarkable, one of many small appointments and outings that formed part of most couples' calendars. They drove home together sometime after 9 p.m. When they arrived home, Mary went to bed and Colin went to shower. At 16 minutes past midnight that night, now the 1st of March, a call came through to emergency services. The man on the line, Colin Whelan, said his wife had fallen down the stairs. He explained that Mary, who was later found wrapped in a duvet, had somehow lost her footing on the narrow staircase and now lay motionless at the bottom of the flight. He said he had been in the shower moments earlier when he heard a heavy, repeated noise. His words were, "Thud, thud, thud." The 999 operator asked for details of Mary's condition. Whelan reported that she was not breathing. He was instructed to begin CPR immediately. The urgency of the operator's voice was clear. Every second mattered. Paramedics arrived at 12:30 and found Mary lying at the bottom of the stairs. She had blood on her face. She was not breathing. Colin repeatedly asked them, "Is she gone?" They noticed he had no blood on his hands or face. Colin wept as the paramedics attempted to save Mary's life. He asked if his wife was dead. He grew angry as he asked repeatedly, and the paramedics told him they couldn't say yet. Colin told them, "I can read between the fucking lines." He pointed to a tear in Mary's sleeve and suggested she might have caught it on the banister of the stairs before she fell. The paramedics transported Mary to Beaumont Hospital in Dublin. But despite efforts to save her, she was pronounced dead soon after arrival. Colin got dressed and got into the car with a fireman to drive to the hospital. As the fireman called to the home of Mary's brother and told him to travel to the hospital, Colin sat in the car crying. At first glance, it could have been a terribly sad domestic accident. The stairs were steep and narrow, kind of place where a slip could have tragic consequences. But almost immediately, details at the scene raised doubts. One of the doctors, Dr. Ali, noticed something unusual while inserting a tube into Mary's trachea. He came across marks on her neck and chest that were not consistent with a fall down the stairs. He also noticed she was cold, too cold to have died in the last hour or so. Colin told hospital workers he hadn't seen the fall. They were hoping to understand if there could have been some reason for the fall which had resulted in her death. He said he'd found Mary not moving but knew nothing else. Sister Catherine Galvin, a nurse at Beaumont that night, spotted something telling about Colin himself. In the bright lights of the hospital, she saw what appeared to be fresh scratches on his chest, marks that looked like trails of fingernails. It was as if someone had clawed at him. She went to tell Gardaí what she had seen. Gardaí asked Colin questions about the day and that evening. He said that he had taken a shower. They asked Colin about the scratches on his chest. Colin said he wasn't scratched. Then he looked down and saw the marks. He went pale as he realized what he was looking at. He then told Gardaí it must have happened after he had found Mary, following the fall. He then added a new detail to his version of events, saying Mary had in fact reached out to him when he found her, flailing her hands at him as he tried to help her. But taken together with Mary's bruises, the puzzle pieces pointed towards an ugly scenario. Mary had been in a violent struggle, likely strangled, and Colin bore scratch marks consistent with a victim fighting back against her attacker. Gardaí brought Colin to a room in the hospital to examine the scratches on his chest. They counted 3 scratches. By the time Mary Goff was pronounced dead at the hospital, Garda detectives were already treating the house on Clonard Street as a potential crime scene. Colin Whelan was asked to visit Balbriggan Garda Station to make a formal statement. He told them the same story he had been telling overnight. Later that same day, state pathologist Dr. Mary Cassidy performed a post-mortem examination on Mary's body and confirmed everyone's worst suspicions. Dr. Cassidy found clear evidence of external pressure having been applied to the neck, a distinct horizontal bruise on the side of Mary's neck, and hemorrhaging beneath the skin, indicating she had been choked to death. There were no severe head wounds or broken bones, injuries that might be expected in an accidental fall down a steep flight of stairs. Instead, the cause of death was incontrovertible: asphyxiation by ligature. Strangulation. There was no doubt now. Mary Goff had been murdered. When the state pathologist carried out a post-mortem, the doubt solidified into something more definitive. Mary Goff had not died from a fall. Her injuries were not consistent with an unfortunate accident on the stairs. Instead, the examination revealed clear evidence of ligature strangulation. At any crime scene, be it a simple burglary or a suspicious death, every detail is important. The first Garda at the scene, the investigating detectives, the local scene's crime examiner, or in more serious cases, the technical bureau or national scene's crime unit, all make meticulous notes, take measurements. Maps may be drawn up. Everything is recorded, photographed, filmed. Everything in situ at the time the incident is discovered must be noted. Each team member has a specific role. Photographs, ballistics, mapping, fingerprints. Each expert laser-focused on what the scene can tell them if approached methodically. And, in suspicious death investigations, the most important exhibit is the deceased themselves. The forensic scenes of crime examiners are constantly vigilant and looking for possible signs, pointers, that may help tell the story of what happened. Something apparently inconsequential may later turn out to be the key to unlocking a mystery. An open window, a single speck of blood, or maybe a discarded dressing gown belt. Investigators immediately suspected that the belt from Mary's dressing gown, found lying on the bed in the master bedroom, was the murder weapon. Forensic testing confirmed their suspicions. Traces of Mary's blood and DNA were found on the belt, adding weight to the theory that it had been pressed against her throat with lethal force. Confronted with this evidence, Colin Whelan continued to feign ignorance. He kept pushing the story that perhaps Mary's dressing gown belt or sleeve had somehow caught on the stair banister and caused her to trip, fatally entangling herself in the process. He grew irate as questions continued. He said Mary fell and there was no more to it. Investigators knew better. A forensic examination of the house told a different story. Small blood spots were discovered in the master bedroom and on the upstairs landing, areas Mary could not have reached if she had simply fallen from the top of the stairs down to the bottom. Those blood traces, along with the belt and the scratches on Colin's torso, painted a clear picture of a violent assault. The Gardaí thought Colin had murdered his wife. They began to think it had all been planned. This conclusion marked a turning point. What began as an apparent accident had now been seen for what it was. The focus of the investigation shifted. Detectives began to look at Colin Whelan, not as the distraught husband of a young woman killed in a heartbreaking household accident, but as the prime suspect in her murder. At the time of Mary's death, Colin had presented himself as a grieving husband in shock. He attended her funeral and accepted condolences from neighbours and friends. He sat with his own family, away from Mary's. Outwardly, he played the part expected of him. He played it well. Publicly, anyway. But behind the facade, investigators were uncovering details that told a very different story. The team from the Garda Technical Bureau returned to the house on Clonard Street in Balbriggan to conduct a full forensic examination. They found the bath mat damp, indicating Colin had indeed been in the shower around the time of Mary's death, but their attention quickly moved from his account of the evening to his behaviour in the days that followed. Mary's family had questions from the outset. To them, the suggestion that she had accidentally fallen down the stairs seemed hard to fathom. They pressed Gardaí to dig deeper, and when the results of the post-mortem were returned, their suspicions were confirmed. Detectives began piecing together a timeline. They spoke with neighbours, colleagues, and friends. They learned that the marriage, while outwardly picture-perfect, had experienced tensions. Mary's friends said she sometimes appeared withdrawn. She had confided to one or two people that Colin could be controlling. It was nothing definitive, but enough to raise concern in retrospect. The more pressing evidence came from the Technical Bureau. Gardaí seized Colin's computer and began a forensic search of his internet history. What they uncovered was chilling. In the months leading up to Mary's death, Colin had repeatedly searched for methods of killing. His queries included phrases such as, how to strangle without leaving marks, death by asphyxiation, and how long before the brain dies without oxygen. Investigators found he had studied the crimes of American serial killer Henry Lewis Wallace, who strangled victims with towels to avoid leaving obvious evidence. Gardaí were shocked to uncover the similarities to Mary's case. The ligature used in her murder was a belt from a dressing gown, applied in a manner consistent with the techniques Colin had researched. The towel he had apparently considered using was later found near Mary's body. Gardaí, scouring Colin's work computer, discovered he had been looking into these methods of killing and these brutal crimes since 3 weeks before his wedding to Mary. The computer records were damning. They established not only premeditation, but also planning and an intent to cover up. Colin had not acted in a moment of rage or madness. He had studied methods of killing his wife, covering it up, and moving on with his life. He weighed the options, and then carried them out in Mary's own home, the place where she was supposed to be safe. breaking his lifelong vow to love and cherish his wife. It was a shocking and disgusting crime. Colin's secret online activity was not limited to these grim explorations of murder and its methods, but he had been visiting online dating sites as well, particularly sites for people searching for extramarital affairs. He had begun an online relationship with a Welsh woman, Helen Shepherd, under the username Celtic Tackle. He told her he had been married for just a few months before his wife died in a car accident and his father was dying from cancer. They spoke daily and Colin had agreed to visit her in Wales. Gardaí made contact with Helen and she was shocked to learn what they told her and promised to help with any investigations. Investigators also discovered something that only heightened their suspicion and began to outline a potential motive for Mary's murder by Colin. In June 2000, several months before their wedding, they signed a joint life insurance policy. The value was 400,000 punts, around 500,000 euros in today's money. The payout was structured so that if either spouse died within the following 10 years, the surviving partner would inherit the full amount. For a young couple, the figure was unusually high. A financial advisor later remarked that the size of the policy was inappropriate and highly questionable. Despite this, the paperwork was completed. For many couples, life insurance was a routine formality. It was often presented as a sensible precaution designed to provide financial protection in case something terrible happened. Detectives discovered that Colin had arranged much of the paperwork himself. Mary's role was minimal. She had simply signed the forms, seemingly without questioning the details. When set alongside the post-mortem findings and the digital trail of internet searches, the motive became clear. Mary's death would have left Colin a wealthy man. As the case against him strengthened, Colin's behaviour began to draw further suspicion. In interviews with Gardaí, his account of the night changed and came under close scrutiny. He could not consistently explain the scratches on his chest. Initially, he said Mary had scratched him during his attempts to revive her, but the explanation did not fit the medical evidence. Paramedics who had attended the scene told detectives they had seen no sign that Colin had performed CPR. His arms and hands showed no marks of exertion that might be found on someone who has tirelessly performed CPR. Mary's body also showed none of the bruising typically caused by compressions. The 999 operator who had taken Colin's emergency call confirmed she had given him clear instructions. To investigators, the absence of CPR was another indication that Colin had not behaved as an innocent husband would in such circumstances. The Garda investigation soon reached a point of no return. On the basis of the forensic evidence, the life insurance policy, and the incriminating internet history, Colin Whelan was arrested and charged with the murder of Mary Gough. Under questioning, he stuck to his story and all of its details, as he always had. But when the Gardaí asked about the scratches on his chest, he began to answer each question with, "No comment." As Gardaí slowly revealed their wealth of evidence, particularly his online activities, he became less confident, less defiant. Yet Colin Whelan still admitted to nothing. By the end of the interview, he was no longer putting on the show of a bereaved husband willing to cooperate whoever he could. The community in Stamullen and Balbriggan was stunned. Outwardly, Mary and Colin had seemed like any other newly married couple planning renovations, attending family gatherings, and talking about starting a family. The revelation that Colin had possibly murdered his wife for financial gain after months of planning shattered that illusion. In preparing for trial, prosecutors built their case around three central pillars: the post-mortem evidence of strangulation, the financial motive created by the life insurance policy, and the digital trail of premeditation. Together, they painted a picture of deliberate and calculated murder by a cold, remorseless man. But before the trial could be heard, despite the objections of Gardaí, Colin Whelan was released on bail. In mid-2001, the High Court allowed Colin Whelan out on a bond under strict conditions. He had to surrender his passport, post a substantial surety and report regularly to his local Garda station. The decision drew huge criticism. Many questioned how a man accused of such a brutal murder could be free to walk the streets while awaiting trial. For Mary's family, already devastated by her loss, it was an added torment for them to see him out in public while she had been brutally strangled to death. For nearly 2 years, Whelan remained technically free, on bail, living in the Balbriggan area. Outwardly, he complied with the terms of his release. He checked in at the Garda station as required and kept a low profile as the legal process moved forward. His trial was eventually scheduled for October 2003. But in the spring of that year, things took a dramatic turn. On the 12th of March 2003, Whelan told his family he was going out for a drive. He was due to arrive at Balbriggan Garda station that evening to sign on as part of his bail conditions. When he failed to show up at the Garda station to sign on, the Gardaí contacted his family home and were told nobody had seen him since he went out for a drive earlier that day. After a search, Gardaí located Whelan's green Peugeot 206, parked near the edge of the cliffs at Hoathead, a windswept peninsula overlooking the Irish Sea. The car had been left at a popular scenic spot on Upper Cliff Road. Nearby was a winding path, popular with tourists and locals, which stretched across the summit of cliffs that marked the edge of the land. Beyond those cliffs was only the vast blue of the Irish Sea. Inside, officers found personal belongings, including an empty gin bottle on the driver's seat. The scene hinted at a grim possibility. The cliffs at Hoath rise sharply above the crashing water below, and jagged rocks break through the waves driving into the coastline. A fall from that height would be fatal, with the body carried away by the tide likely never to be recovered. Initial impressions were that Colin Whelan had taken his own life. Searches were launched. Garda units combed the headland. The Coast Guard swept the coastline from the air while boats and divers scoured the waters below. For Gardaí, a new and more complex investigation was beginning. The murder of Mary Gough was no longer just about what had happened inside a house in Balbriggan. It was also about what had become of the man accused of killing her. Was he dead at the bottom of the Irish Sea, or still alive somewhere, in hiding, keeping a low profile, watching and waiting? Despite those extensive searches, nobody was recovered from the sea. Whelan had given no clear indications of suicidal intent, and the timing raised questions just months before his trial. This apparent suicide conveniently removed him from the dock. As the days passed without a discovery, suspicion hardened, if not officially from the Gardaí, then certainly within Mary's family, with her mother Marie telling a journalist in the days after Whelan's disappearance that she did not believe he would have taken his own life. "He thinks too much of himself to have taken his own life. He could be anywhere for all we know," she said. The story was about to take an extraordinary twist. On the 12th of March 2003, Gardaí recovered Colin Whelan's car parked near the cliffs at Hoathead. Inside, officers found some of Whelan's personal belongings, but no sign of him. The location was unsettling. Sheer cliffs dropping into the Irish Sea, with the cold sea waters crashing below. Among the items left behind was an empty bottle of gin on the driver's seat, details that pointed towards the possibility of suicide. A fall from that height could easily carry a body out to sea, making recovery unlikely. At first glance, it appeared Whelan may have chosen to end his life rather than face the music for his actions. Gardaí, though, were not entirely convinced. Whelan was a liar. He was calculated and manipulative. Faking his own death was not beyond him. The likelihood grew that Colin Whelan had indeed faked his suicide. What looked like despair was, in fact, deception. He had vanished, leaving behind a devastated family still waiting for justice, and Gardaí now considering if they were in fact pursuing a wife-murdering fugitive. With no answers and no closure, and mounting layers to the mystery, Mary Gough's family remained trapped in limbo. They visited Mary's grave. She had been robbed of justice. While Colin Whelan's October 2003 trial date came and went, with the accused still nowhere to be found. An international manhunt had been launched, but there were few leads. Whelan had no known close contacts abroad, and his digital trail was cold. Interpol circulated his details, yet Colin had been careful and lucky in covering his tracks. For a time, it seemed he might just get away with murder. In the summer of 2004, on the Spanish island of Mallorca, a man stood serving drinks at the Squadron Bar in the upmarket resort of Puerto Portals. He had worked there for 2 years, since he had left Ireland and started a new life on the sun-bleached island. His name, as far as anyone in Mallorca knew, was Martin Sweeney. He had the passport to prove it. He now even had the Spanish government ID to prove it. And he also went by the name Keane. He had a wide circle of friends, and he had a girlfriend. He had grown very comfortable in his life there. His life in Spain was a full one, but it was not a real one. In fact, this life had only existed for those 2 years. But in one moment, the life of Martin Sweeney was turned upside down. In June 2004, a group of Irish couples holidaying in Mallorca were enjoying their break when they spotted a familiar face working at the Squadron Bar. At first, they couldn't quite place him, a face that looked familiar. But how did we know him? Then it clicked. A friendly Irish barman looked exactly like Colin Whelan, the fugitive whose wanted photo had been plastered across Crimeline the year before, the man accused of murdering his wife 3 years ago in Ireland, the man who went off the edge of a cliff, disappeared, missing, maybe dead. The keen-eyed Irish couples on the Sun holiday had uncovered the answer Gardaí and the Gough family had been hoping for and had started the unravelling of Whelan's complex deception. As Gardaí learned of the discovery, they contacted Interpol, who sent plainclothes police officers to the pub to observe the barman. Interpol confirmed the suspicions and noted Whelan had made no attempt to change his appearance. Then on the 10th of July 2004, Spanish police surrounded the bar and waited for Colin to arrive to work. As he did, they moved in. He protested that he was Martin Sweeney and all this was a mistake. But they knew who he really was. The double life of Martin Sweeney had come to an abrupt end. Gardaí set about arranging an extradition so Colin could face justice, and also began piecing together his elaborate ploy to evade standing trial for Mary's murder. Months before he was due to face trial, Whelan put an audacious escape plan into motion. Somehow, despite having surrendered his real passport, Colin Whelan managed to obtain a false one under the alias Martin Sweeney. Sweeney, the real Sweeney, was a caretaker at a local school in Gormanston, where the Whelan family lived. Sweeney was the same age as Colin, and had never left Ireland, so had no passport of his own. He had no knowledge of Colin's deception. Colin knew enough of Sweeney's life to be able to apply for and obtain a passport in his name. Then, armed with this new identity, he waited patiently for the right moment to disappear. While Gardaí pondered the possible suicide of the prime suspect and the prospect that he lay at the bottom of the Irish Sea, in reality, Whelan was soaking up the sun on the Iberian Peninsula. The wife killer had staged the suicide before slipping out of Ireland using the Martin Sweeney passport, possibly travelling through the UK to avoid immediate detection. He eventually made his way to Spain, settling on the island of Mallorca, a popular holiday destination, where he began building a new life. Far from keeping a low profile, Colin Whelan was enjoying his new life. Posing as Martin Sweeney, an easygoing Irish expat, he ingratiated himself into the local community. In Mallorca's bars and beaches, Martin, who also went by the name Keane, was outgoing and affable. He picked up regular bar work, a role that allowed him to socialise and blend in. Over the next year, Whelan built a wide circle of friends who knew him only as Martin. He even started dating a local woman. To complete his cover, he was vetted by Spanish authorities and issued a national identity card under the name Martin Sweeney. the same name on his false Irish passport. With a legitimate ID, steady work, and friends, Whelan felt untouchable. After murdering his wife, he had achieved what many criminals only dream of. He had escaped without a trace and reinvented himself. But by the July of 2004, just over a year after he had vanished into thin air, Colin Whelan was back in Ireland in handcuffs, finally facing a courtroom for Rary's murder. The courts wasted no time. Just as Paul Kearney offered Whelan an immediate trial date, given that proceedings had already been delayed for so long. But in a final show of cowardice, Whelan initially declined, forcing further postponements. For Mary's family, each extra day of delay was agony, compounding the suffering already inflicted. His flight from justice had stolen 2 years from them, and now he added further insult by dragging out the legal process, even after his capture. At last, in April 2005, 4 years after Mary Gough's death, the case reached its conclusion. Facing a mountain of evidence, and with no plausible defence, Colin Whelan changed his plea to guilty, admitting that he had murdered his wife. In the Central Criminal Court in Dublin, the 34-year-old Whelan finally was held to account for his crimes. Through his counsel, he offered a brief statement of sorrow, an apology to Mary's family, saying he accepted full responsibility for her death. He acknowledged the pain he had caused, and indirectly his own cowardice in attempting to escape justice. These words, coming after years of lies and evasion, brought little comfort to those who knew and loved Mary. Mr. Justice Paul Kearney did not mince words at the sentencing. In decades on the bench, he said this was the most calculated and callous killing he had ever encountered. The judge was outraged not only by the meticulous planning of the murder, but also by Whelan's cold-blooded attempt to cheat the justice system and the additional trauma he inflicted on Mary's family by faking his own death. Normally, any time a defendant spends in custody before sentencing would count towards their prison term, but Justice Paul Kearney pointedly refused to credit any of Colin's prior jail time, since Whelan had unlawfully absconded for over a year and had also been granted the controversial bail in the lead-up to his disappearance. The judge ordered that Whelan's mandatory life sentence would commence from the date of his plea of guilty in April 2005, with no portion shaved off for the period he was on the run. In practical terms, it was the harshest life sentence the court could impose. Kearney further emphasized that a transcript of the sentencing hearing would remain on file as required reading for any future parole board considering release for this most calculated killer. In the courtroom, Mary Gough's family confronted Colin Whelan for the first time since his disappearance. Mary's brother David spoke with raw emotion as he delivered a victim impact statement. Turning toward Whelan, he said, "You caused devastation to our family when you brutally strangled Mary, and you took a piece of us too." He branded Colin a coward for fleeing before the trial and condemned him for thinking that he could outrun the law. "You tried to rob us of justice. You thought you were above the law, but you are not. Justice has finally been done here today." With palpable anger and grief, he declared, "Mary's only crime was loving you too much. No time in prison will ever be enough." As David spoke, the Gough family, Mary's widowed mother and her brothers, stood united, mourning not only the loss of their beloved Mary, but also the deep betrayal by the man they had once welcomed as family. Colin Whelan was led away to begin his life behind bars at Wheatfield Prison. The reverberations of his actions, however, continued to be felt. The case prompted public debate in Ireland about the granting of bail to those accused of heinous crimes and about international protocols for tracking down fugitives. It also stands as a stark cautionary tale about how greed and deceit can lurk between the surface of a seemingly happy marriage. Mary Gough's life was cut short in the cruelest of ways, but thanks to diligent police work and a bit of luck on a sunny Iberian island, her killer ultimately did not escape justice. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and review, sharing it to your story on social media, leaving a comment below, or simply telling a friend you enjoyed it. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Siobhan Walsh is our producer. Sound editing and design are by Neil Kavanagh. This episode was written by Darren Cleary, edited by Owen Brennan and myself, John Sweetman. Join me next time as we open another case and follow the evidence wherever it leads. In the end, everything done in the dark comes to light. Next week on Lines of Inquiry, the Midlands Letters case. A story of anonymous letters that spread panic and fear across the middle of Ireland. A man driven by pent-up rage and a sick obsession. And the race against time to find him.